Okay, so we are in the process of looking at the idea of right view on the Noble Eightfold Path, the very first factor. And we are now going to look at the idea of right view from the, like, the ordinary person, what it means for everybody basically to have some idea of right view. And the first aspect of this right view that I'm going to look at is the last one here. There are recluses and Brahmins. In other words, these are just like spiritual people, right? Recluses and Brahmins. There are spiritual people of right conduct and right practice in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. This is the first aspect I'm going to have a look at, because this is almost like the foundation of right view. And without that, without some idea that there are people who have seen something more and something else, there is no basis for any confidence or faith in anything, really. And so that is kind of the foundation stone. And this next sutta is quite a well-known one. It's about the meaning of the word kalyana mitta, good friendship. And probably something you've heard before, but I think it's worthwhile having another look at. This is how it goes. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans, where there was a town of the Sakyans called Nagaraka. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship." "Not so, Ananda, not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to expect it that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path." So, the Noble Eightfold Path, there you are. So that's what you will cultivate. So in other words, this is stands at the very beginning, right? The very base of the Noble Eightfold Path. If you have a right friendship, then that will come as a consequence. I think Ananda is probably thinking here that he's praising the idea of Kalyanamitta by saying, "Oh, this is half of the holy life, right? That's how important, it's incredibly important." And then, and then to his surprise, perhaps, the Buddha says, "No, it's not half. That's not enough. You've got to praise it more than that. It is the entire thing. It is everything in the holy life." And it's a very powerful, it's a strong statement. And I remember when I first read this, I thought, you know, it's like with so many things, you don't really think about it properly until later on. I thought, yeah, you know, the Buddha is probably, maybe he's exaggerating a bit for effect or whatever. I mean, surely, you know, there is Kalyanamitta, then there is, what about all the other factors of the holy life, right? You have to be kind and compassionate. You have to be, practice your precepts. You have to read the suttas and reflect on, contemplate death and all these kind of things. What about all that? Surely it can't be everything here. But actually, it is precisely because it stands at the very beginning. It is one of those very fundamental things. It is for that reason that it is the entire thing. In other words, there is no holy life. There is no spiritual practice. There is nothing without somebody who actually has that insight to begin with so they can guide you in the right direction. It only exists, the whole idea of Buddhism only exists because somebody arises in the world who understands these things and then proclaims that spiritual life. And this ties in very much with this Buddhist idea of non-self, of anatta. And that, you know, we are what we are as human beings from a Buddhist point of view. We are just the sum total of all the things that have conditioned us in this life and that also conditioned us in past life. Who you are now, everything you think, everything you experience, right? The way you make decisions in life, all your habits, who you are as a person, all that is really just the sum total of all the conditionings that have influenced you in this life and also, of course, in past lives. That's who we are. And because you are because what you are is what you are conditioned to be. It means that if you don't have that conditioning factor, which is a noble friend, which is like the Buddha who has seen, well, that condition is missing, there is no way that you're going to be able to enter the Noble Eightfold Path. The condition is missing here. And Ajahn Brahm uses this, somebody reminded me the other day, Ajahn Brahm uses the simile of the driverless bus, right? You're driving around, it's like you, this is like your life, right? Driving around and the bus goes through all kind of terrain. Sometimes, you know, you're enjoying yourself. All the time it's miserable, right? And it's bad. And you, after a while you wonder, you know, how come I'm going through all this suffering in life? Why is it that sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm suffering, sometimes it's neutral? What's going on? And then one day you want to check out who is driving this bus, right? Get straighten them out, get them to drive through the nice stuff and forget about the bad stuff. And this is like the insight into the who you are as a person, insight in to the five aggregates of grasping we're talking about this morning. And you go and you look for the driver and there's nobody there, right? The seat is empty. There's nobody there. It's just this kind of process going along and it kind of just travels according to the prevailing conditions, right? Like the rudderless ship on the ocean, if the wind comes from the north, the ship goes to the south. There's no engine. There's nobody driving it in any particular direction. It just moves according to cause and conditions. And of course, what we want to do then, and this is, I'm going to take the simile of Ajahn Brahm a little bit further. What we want to do is instead of having a driverless bus, you want to have a Buddha sitting at the wheel of that bus, right? This is what we do by reading the suttas. This is what you do by understanding this practice. Is that we are replacing, instead of having an empty seat there, we're actually putting, in a sense, the Buddha in charge. We're putting the Kalyanamitta in charge. So this is the difference between having a Kalyanamitta, is that you have the Buddha driving the bus. Now sometimes, you know, if you're an ordinary person, even if you have the Buddha driving the bus, you're not very happy with that sometimes, right? You know, don't really want to go where the Buddha goes. So maybe you get off the bus for a while and get on again, right? This is what happens. Because you're not really happy, Buddha's asking too much, I don't want to give up all these things, etc. So this is a problem. And then once you become an Arya, that's when you are really on the bus full time, and you're really driving towards Nibbana. But before that, you're only partially on the bus, stepping on and off every now and again. So this is why this is so important, right? Kalyanamitta. It is so fundamental, and it really is 100% of the holy life, of the spiritual path. And I should have known better. The Buddha doesn't usually mince his words. It's usually pretty, you know, when the Buddha says something, that's exactly what it means. And someone needs to take these sayings very, think about them very carefully to understand what is going on here. So that is the idea of 100% of the spiritual life and why that is so important. I like the translation here, the translation of good friends, good companions, good comrades, right? It sounds like something out of the Soviet Union or something, the good comrades. But I think it's just Bhikkhubodhi. I spoke to him about this. Isn't comrade a slightly strange translation? And he said, I'm just kind of trying to find some other term, which means like friends. So I put comrade in there. So that's the reason why it's there. It doesn't have any kind of communist overtones or anything like that. Okay, so let us see what the rest of this sutta has to say. And how, Ananda, does a bhikkhu who has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path? Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu develops right view, which is based on seclusion, based on dispassion, and based on cessation, maturing in release. He develops right intention, or right folk, or right purpose, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right stillness, which is based on seclusion, based on dispassion, based on cessation, maturing in release. It is in this way, Ananda, that a bhikkhu who has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path. So you basically, the point he's making is simply that when you have that spiritual friendship, especially the Buddha, then this is the consequence of that. This is how you practice. you actually do develop this Noble Eightfold Path as a consequence of that. And it's, of course, it's not just the Buddha who is your spiritual companion, right? The Buddha is the most important one. He's like the root teacher, the root spiritual companion. But, of course, there are others as well. And I'm sure most of you here, you will listen to talks by different teachers, such as Ajahn Brahm or whoever it might be. And, of course, all of these, too, are spiritual friends, in a sense. And you can say that anybody, you know, who you practice with, maybe the people here on the retreat or people you hang out with in your Buddhist practice or whatever it is, all of these people are to some extent spiritual friends. And actually it's quite useful to think about that. What is it that makes somebody a spiritual friend? What is the distinction between somebody who's a spiritual friend and somebody who's a spiritual enemy, right? Who is a spiritual enemy? In Siddhas it's called the papamitta, the bad or the evil friend, quite literally. So what is this kind of spiritual friend and the spiritual enemy, if you like? How do we distinguish between those two? And I think it's like with everything else on the Buddhist path. Anything you do in life, anything you choose, any choice you make, anything that kind of brings you forward on the Buddhist path, that helps you to increase your good qualities, to move in the right direction, to go down in the bad qualities, those people who help you with increasing the good ones and going down in the bad ones, they are your kalyana mittas. Those friends that you hang out with and they make the bad qualities go up and the good ones decline, well, they are like your bad friends, right? The papa mitta. It's a very simple way of distinguishing between what sort of people are useful in the spiritual life. But what does this mean? This thing that he has just mentioned here, this idea of how we cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. And just very briefly, because it's nice to know a little bit about what's going on, I don't want to get too much into this because it's probably going a little bit too much to one side of what the main topic is. But basically, he developed right view based on seclusion, right? And this is this idea that you need some degree of seclusion in your life to be able to practice this path fully. This path is based on the idea that you have to withdraw a little bit. And the way that withdrawal happens, it happens first physically, right? So you come here to Jhana Grove, this is some degree of seclusion you have here. This is already a good start. It means that you are not so involved in your ordinary life, you pull back a little bit from your ordinary life. It means that you are a little bit more detached, you have a little bit more perspective, right? And as a monastic, it means kind of living out perhaps in your kuti somewhere in the forest. Perhaps it means not living anywhere, just wandering around. There's all kind of things people do in monasticism. But there's that physical seclusion. And from that physical seclusion, something else happens. And what happens from that is what is called the citta viveka, kaya viveka, citta viveka. You get mental seclusion. Physical seclusion leads eventually to mental seclusion, because it is normally the fact that we are so embroiled and so attached and so involved with things in the world. There's an involvement that tends to always give rise to the defilements and the problems in the mind. If we withdraw physically, we're taking the first step to also being able to withdraw mentally. That physical withdrawal affects the mind in a very powerful way. And this is why people go on retreat, right? Precisely for that reason. Because you withdraw a bit physically, and then it actually affects the mind as well. So this is the first aspect. You go into seclusion to some extent. That is where you really have a chance to develop the mind, or a better chance. And that withdrawing into seclusion then means that your meditation starts to take off. And dispassion, it says here, happens. Well, here it probably should be fading away, is probably a better translation here. Viraga has these two meanings, and when it is conjoined with cessation, usually it means fading away. So things start to fade away, right? This is what happens on this path. So based on fading away, in other words, in your meditation practice, again, we're talking about this morning, things start to fade away. There is less stuff going on, right? And then when things start to fade away, you get a different perspective on the world. Those things that have faded away, you start to understand them in a different light. This is such an important aspect of this whole process of meditation, getting that perspective that happens from fading away. And then fading away, they cease, right? When something ceases, that means, you see that thing in an entirely different light when something has disappeared altogether. Again, this is what we mean by insight. Insights come from these kind of experiences when things cease completely. So this is all of these things are developed on this basis. And the more they are developed on this basis, then eventually the whole thing matures here in release. Vosagga parinama. Vosagga is this idea of being released from something. So you are released from all these things. And this is how the Noble Eightfold Path works. And what you are released from, of course, is suffering. And this is what the second paragraph here is about, expanding on this a little bit. And by the following method too, Ananda, it may be understood how the entire holy life is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. By relying upon me as a good friend, Ananda, beings subject to birth are freed from birth. Being subject to old age are freed from old age. Being subject to death are freed from death. Being subject to sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair are freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. By this method, Ananda, it may be understood how the entire holy life, this is the brahmacharya, the spiritual life, is the latest translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. So in other words, if you want to overcome the deep-rooted problems of life, this is what you have to do. You practice the Noble Eightfold Path, and then eventually you overcome all of these problems. And then you are happy, right? That's kind of the highest happiness on the Buddhist path. So that is the famous sutta on half the holy life, and how this Kalyanamitta idea is absolutely foundational, how it stands at the beginning of everything here. And there are a few things like that in life that are absolutely crucial. Kalyanamitta is one of those. Another one is what they call appamada, right? Pamada is being heedless. Appamada is being heedful. Heedful means like you reflect, right? You are careful. You're not kind of being completely stupid, rushing around in the world, but you reflect about things. You try to look at existence properly. You're heedful about things. And this is another thing. If you're not heedful, then even if the Buddha tells you the Dhamma, you just sort of walk away. You don't even think about it properly, right? So you have to have the right spiritual faculties to be able to even appreciate this Dhamma. And then there's all these other kind of basic things that have to be in place to make it possible for you to get started. So this is one of those very important things. Okay. So that is the importance of hearing the Dhamma from those who have right conduct and right practice. And of course, what they say, what the interesting thing here, is that those people of right conduct and right practice, what the point that is being made here, is that they have realized by direct knowledge. This word direct knowledge means that it is an immediate personal understanding. And what they have realized and what they declare is this world and the other world. So this is like the basic thing that somebody who has a deep spiritual insight in Buddhism, that's the basic thing that they declare. This is the kind of the root thing that gives you a different perspective on everything. The idea of this world and the other world, right? Life is not limited to this little life that we have right here. It is just actually the world is just this entirely different thing from what we think it is. It is this ongoing movement from life to life, going almost infinitely into the past and potentially infinitely in the future. It is very, very different from what we think it is. And the question is, well, when we start to look at the world in that way, when we start to think instead of this narrow scope, we open up our sight, we take on confidence the things that the Buddha is talking about. What effect does that have? How should we relate to that? And these are some of the suttas I want to bring up now, is what this actually does. And these are very almost frightening, some of these suttas, the way the Buddha talks about this. And yet, they are also very powerful, I feel. And for that reason, they are worth thinking a little bit about. And the first one of these suttas here is called the Tears. There's a number of these suttas found in the Pali Canon. This is found in the Sanghita Nikaya, number 15. This is known as the Annamattaka Sanghita, the Sanghita on unknowable beginnings or something like that, or beginningless beginnings, or maybe that's a bit of an oxymoron, but it's the lack of beginnings, basically. And this is a flavor of what these suttas are like. So, at Savati, because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. What do you think, bhikkhus? Which is more, the stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered on through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this or the water in the four great oceans? Right? I'm sure you can imagine what the answer is already, so we can just stop there for a second. So this is quite an interesting statement in many ways. Let's just have a quick look at this. So the bhikkhus, this samsara, right? Samsara literally means something like the wandering on, right? The keeping going, the kind of ceaseless, restless wandering on from existence to existence, is without discoverable beginning here. Right, this is the first thing, and this is already a little bit interesting. Sometimes people ask, well, in Buddhism, how does creation happen in Buddhism? How does everything begin? What is the Buddhist idea of the starting of the universe? And Buddhism is one of the very few kind of spiritual teachings which doesn't actually have a start. There is no saying it began here, or it might have an ending, but there's certainly no beginning according to Buddhism. And it kind of makes sense, right? There's always another cause earlier than the previous one. It always kind of goes back and back forevermore. And the idea, of course, is that if you try to look into your past lives, and the Buddha says you can do that, you can remember your past lives, you can just go back and back and back. And as you keep on going back, there is no first point. There is no discoverable beginning, right? This is the importance of the word discoverable here. You cannot actually discover a beginning here. And so you see, the Buddha doesn't say that there is no beginning, because that would also be overstepping the mark. All you can do is go backwards. You can't say there is no beginning, but all you can say is that as far as back as you go, you won't discover a beginning. That's really all you can say here. And so that is an interesting kind of Buddhist take on the kind of origin of the universe, right? How things started. There is no discoverable beginning here. And it's not making a claim that there is no beginning, because that's impossible. You can't go back forever, but there's no discoverable beginning. A first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving here. I like this idea of beings roaming and wandering on, right? It sounds a bit pointless, doesn't it? You're roaming around, wandering on, not really having any direction. That's kind of what I read when I see those words. You're kind of just, now roaming this way, now roaming that way. And sometimes life seems so important, right? It seems like we're heading somewhere. We are kind of, I see some of my friends from university days, they all have a career, right? They're heading in a certain direction. Or when you are at university, you're studying hard to get the right degree, and you think that life has a certain importance, there's a certain kind of thing that you are, moving towards or whatever. And then usually, after a while, you start to wonder, am I actually going anywhere? Where is all this leading? Is it actually heading anywhere at all? And of course, as Ajahn Ram always likes to say, it is all just going in one direction, and that is to your grave. That's really the only place it's going. It's not going anywhere else. And of course, when you die, you look back. You're not really worried about all the things you did, right? Whether you had a career, whether you were successful, that's kind of all become irrelevant. when you die, the only thing that people think of when they die is how they live their life. Were you kind? Did you do some bad things? Were you generous? That is what you remember when you pass away. All this other stuff becomes completely irrelevant. And we can see here what is going on is that your perspective on life, from when you are young and looking forward, and when you're old and looking back, the perspective is almost 180 degrees different. When you're young, all this thing about morality and all that, okay, maybe it's important, but I haven't got time for that now. Now it's career and all this kind of stuff. This is what matters, right? And then when you look back, when you die, it's actually the exact opposite. All of that other stuff is irrelevant. It's how you live your life that really matters. And this is why it is so powerful to use that death recollection right now. Because it means that instead of waiting till you die, right now you can get that perspective. And it means that it's much easier to live your life wisely right away instead of waiting till you're dying. Of course, then it obviously is too late anyway. So basically, it is just, we're just roaming and wandering around, right? It's pretty kind of, it's aimless. It's not really, it doesn't really have any purpose. And only time you understand that it doesn't have a purpose is really when you are about to die. That's when you start to understand that it wasn't really all that purposeful after all. And it's a kind of wake-up call. I always had that feeling in my life. What is this all about? You know, why am I here? What am I doing all this for? I always had a little bit of that purpose, maybe because I was a Buddhist in the past life or something. But to me, that always made sort of sense. But also, I was also deluded enough, of course, to think that certain things were important. You got to get on with things and do things. So you roam around, and the reason why you roam and wander around is because you are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. There's a very nice little pair of phrases there. Hindered by ignorance because you don't understand, right? You don't see clearly. In fact, you tend to see things upside down from what they are really like. So because you don't see what's going on, because all you see is this one little life, because all you see is the happiness of sensual pleasures, because all you see is all these things, because you don't understand the big picture, because you don't understand the idea of suffering, because you don't understand what life is truly about, you are blinded by ignorance. You're literally blind. You cannot see what's going on, and that's why you are hindered by ignorance. So ignorance stops you from doing what is right, right? It's just like we were saying yesterday, you have to see the world properly before you can start heading in the right direction. If you don't understand the world for what it actually is, you can never guide yourself in the right way. So this is why confidence is so important at the beginning of the spiritual path. Then, not only are you hindered by ignorance, but at the same time, you are fettered by craving. Fettered means you are bound, right? You are bound to samsara. You're bound to the round of rebirth. Craving is what binds you. Craving is what stops you from being released. Craving, it was drive this idea of rebirth again and again. So you can't, there's two things kind of working in pair, right? The one thing that blinds you from seeing things, and the other thing that binds you onto suffering. Basically, you're bound to suffering. That's basically what it means. So there you are. That sounds pretty scary, doesn't it, when you see that? You're roaming around like a blind person, and craving is kind of tying you down, and you don't really know what you're doing. And that's life. Okay. So then the Buddha asked this famous question, what is more, the amount of water that you have wept through this long course, you know, from life to life, remember all kinds of different types of lives, right? Or the waters of the four great oceans? And then they reply, of course, as we understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the stream of tears that we have shed as we roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this alone is more than the water in the four great oceans. Good, good, bhikkhus. It is good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me in such a way. The stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable. This alone is more than the water of the four great oceans. For a long time, bhikkhus, you have experienced the death of a mother. As you have experienced this, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the stream of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, bhikkhus, you have experienced the death of a father, the death of a brother, the death of a sister, the death of a son, the death of a daughter, the loss of relatives, the loss of wealth, the loss through illness. As you have experienced this, weeping and wailing, because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the stream of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. For what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all formations, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So, there you are. So if you start counting up the amount of, if you can measure the amount of tears that you have cried in this life, right? And then you divide that into the amount of water in the oceans, you get some idea of the number of lives that you have been running around crying because of losing relatives and things. So it's quite a large number. So this is this idea that, you know, we just keep on going, we keep on suffering, we keep on having problems. As I was saying the other day, every time you make a choice of attaching to something, and we make these choices all the time to attach to things, right? Attaching to, especially to people, other people, family members, whatever it is. Every time you do that, you are also going to have to experience the suffering as a consequence of that attachment. And this is really what this is about. And when you start to understand this, when you understand, you know, that you have done this kind of thing not only once, right? I mean, I don't know what you feel, but I look back at my own life and I think I actually had in many ways a very good life. I have no right to complain at all, really. But if I were to think that I had to go through it all again, would I kind of want that? And the answer is no way I would want to have to go through that all again. The reason I'm quite happy to be where I'm now is because I feel I have learned something on the way, right? I don't really want to do all of this stuff again. There's been enough troubles, enough problems in this life, that's for sure. And when I look around, I said this is the case for pretty much for everybody. Everybody has had enough troubles and problems in their lives. This is just the way things are. And what the Buddha is saying here is that we tend to do the same things again and again and again and again, right? You go from one life to another one. And because we tend to forget, because we don't carry that knowledge with us, we don't remember what happened in the last one, we tend to do the same things, make the same mistakes, just be just as stupid next time. As I imagine myself being just as stupid in my next life as I've been in this one. Oh, that's terrible, terrible thought. I really don't want to go through all of that stuff again. The upbringing, you know, being a school kid, going to university, you know, having girlfriends and all of that, and then getting a job and working a little bit, and then eventually becoming a monk. That was my best move so far, was becoming a monk. But all of that, I don't want to go through all of that again. It's just, there's just too much pain, too much trouble. And when you start to think about the fact that you have done this so many times, right? Again and again and again, life after life after life. Every time you're blind, you think, whoa, enough. Don't want this anymore. It feels repulsive. It feels something, you are repelled from this. You don't want to have anything to do with this. And this, I think, is what the Buddha is telling us. He has seen what it is like to go through this process. He has understood that because he has recalled his past lives. We haven't done that. So he is like, he's what they call in the sutta as the eye of the world. He says, this is the reality of it. Now, it's up to you whether you're going to have confidence or faith or not. I can't control that. But if you believe that, the result is you have revulsion, it says here, towards all formations. All formations just means all All phenomena, really, that's what it means. You have revulsion towards all phenomena, anything that can be experienced, right? All of that, you get repelled by it. You don't want to have anything more to do with it. This is nibbida, the Pali word. And the interesting thing here, that this word, nibbida, is the next word that follows on from that beautiful sequence we're looking at on the first day. That was yesterday morning. We're saying from stillness, from samadhi, comes yathabhuta jnanadasana, seeing things according to reality. Seeing things according to reality, right? This is this kind of stuff, right? Leads to nibbida, to the revulsion and repulsion. That's the next factor which I had cut out from that sequence. And the next factor after that is viraga. Things start to fade away. You are letting go of things. Dispassion happens. You are no longer interested. You're giving up things. Craving is no longer there. Craving disappears because you understand you cannot have craving for something which is repulsive or something which is not nice. How can you crave for suffering? That's basically what it means. So craving dies down. That's what viraga means here, enough to become dispassionate towards them. That's viraga, you're dispassionate. And then, because craving fades away, because you have seen that you have cried enough, then you are liberated from all those sankharas, all those formations, all that experience. You're no longer interested in all that. So this is how the Buddha tells us about suffering, about the problem of going on life after life, why rebirth is a serious problem. And think about it yourself. Think about the idea of going through things again and again. Some lives you are fortunate, you become a Buddhist, right, and you do live the life well. And then another life you're not so fortunate and you live your life badly, and then you have things that get even worse, right? Even more suffering. It is all so dicey, so uncertain, and so hard sometimes to very, very uncertain, all of this. So this is why the idea of rebirth is actually very powerful in Buddhism. It's a very strong motivating factor to live in the right way. At the very least, it will help you to get a better rebirth next time around. And with a bit of more effort, it will actually get you out of this whole predicament altogether. So it means you're heading in the right direction, right? That's really all we can do in life, is to make sure we're heading in the right direction. As long as you're heading in the right direction, then you are kind of, there is a certain amount of security that comes with that feeling of heading in the right direction. So it is to give you that little bit of extra oomph and impetus. It's not meant to make you depressed, because if it makes you, it's nothing to be depressed about, right? It's just more like, whoa, this is what it is. Okay. Let's go back and experience some happiness in the meditation practice. So let's have a look at the next one. This is more, a little bit more of the same thing. This is called unfortunate, this particular sutta. On one occasion, while dwelling at Samadhi, the Blessed One said this: "Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning, the first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Whenever you see anyone in misfortune, in misery, you can conclude, we too have experienced the same in this long course. For what reason? Because the samsara is without discoverable beginning, etc. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all formations, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them." That's another useful one, right? Even though we have a good life now, sometimes you just to remind yourself when you see something on TV or you hear about something happening in this world and there's plenty of misery going around, we have been there as well, right? We have probably lived in places like Syria or Afghanistan where everything is kind of being, you know, everything is so uncertain. We have been living in refugee camps, you know. We have all of these things we have been through at some stage, even though not in this life. Maybe some of you have even happened to you in this life. I don't know. But certainly it has happened at some stage, right? So when you see those people on TV, instead of feeling that it's alien, it's different, it's far away, it's got nothing to do with you, remember that you too were there, right? that changes your perspective quite powerfully. If you were there, it makes you look at those people in a very different way. It is so easy to feel a distance towards these difficult things. You see wars, bombs blowing up, people being blown apart. We too have been blown apart, right, by bombs and all these kind of things. It happens to everybody. So because of that, you can feel more sense of support, a more sense of a kind of, you know, wow, this actually is very bad. You understand the tragedy of these things in a much more personal sense when you know that you also have been in that situation. And not only that, but it reminds us sometimes one of the dangers of the Buddhist practice, and you hear this sometimes, people sometimes say, oh, it is their fault. They did bad karma and now they're experiencing the results, right? But this is not a very nice way of thinking about the world. And it's not really the right way. It's not how the Buddha encouraged us to think about these things. And the reason for that is because human life is very varied, right? Suddenly things change. And it's not always because of karma. Very often it's just because this is the way human life is. If you're born as a human, many strange things, many difficult things can happen. So never think that the other person is suffering because of bad karma. They're suffering because they're human. They're suffering because they're just like us, right? That's why they're suffering. They happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So the right response is always compassion. It could have been you. Maybe it will be you in the future. You will be in the same situation. So that is the first way to reflect. And that gives more a sense of, you know, a positive kind of, you know, we are in this together in a sense. It's not just them there and we here and we have to kind of look after us and make sure that we are okay and kind of forget about them. We are in this together. And the second thing is that even if sometimes it is about karma, occasionally karma may also have, you know, be a factor in how people live their lives. And certainly if you get reborn perhaps in a bad realm or whatever. But even if that is the case, why is it that people make bad karma? Why is it that we sometimes make bad karma? Very often it is not because we want to make bad karma, because our habits, our delusion, our ignorance, our misunderstanding drive us in the wrong direction. When people are stupid, when they do bad things, and certainly people do many bad things, it's not really because they want to do bad things. I think almost everybody knows, we know in our heart that doing good is equivalent to happiness. Still, we can't stop ourselves from sometimes doing what is bad. So when people do bad things and they reap the results, again, the right response is always compassion. They don't understand. They are blind. They are deluded. Compassion is always the right response. So this is what we see when you see this. Put yourself in that position. Know that you have made the same mistakes. You are in the same position as this. And it kind of it becomes both repelling and at the same time as it gives rise to compassion. It's repelling because you realize that you will be back there again. But also it gives compassion for those people in that situation right now. So it has kind of a positive effect. It both propels you on the path in many ways at the same time. And I got an email. I was in Indonesia quite recently on a teaching schedule in Indonesia, traveling around, and it was quite tiring because we're going by plane from one city to another. Every day it was two plane rides with a kind of stop in between, and then this long talks and talk shows or whatever in the evening, and then next city, and it was quite taxing, the whole thing. But it was also nice, because always nice to teach Dhamma. I find this very, very, very inspiring myself. But then while I was there, I got an email from one of my friends, my old university friends back in Norway. And he emailed me and said that his wife had just committed suicide, right? And of course, very difficult. But actually, in this case, it was even more difficult, because 6 months ago, his son had committed suicide. So then, first of all, his son commits suicide, and then his wife commits suicide, right? And people react just like you reacted now. They think, oh, this is really hard, right? Very difficult when that happens. And of course, it is hard. And there was two things that was very interesting. One thing was, I sent it, most people, when that happens, they don't even know how to react. What am I going to say to this person? I don't know what to say, right? You feel kind of helpless. But as a monk, in a sense, this is kind of where your training as a monastic really comes to the fore. So I was able to, I sent him some very simple things about this too will pass, right? Suicide is just another way of dying. Sometimes it's stigmatized badly in our society, but actually there's nothing too much of, you know, there's nothing to really worry about there. Sometimes suicide may be the right outcome if things are very difficult. It's very hard. You can't really judge these kind of things. Some very simple things I said to him, and he said, wow, that is so profound, right? Thank you for your profound wisdom. And I thought to myself, this is just ordinary stuff. This is what kind of stuff we think every day as Buddhist monastics, you know. It's so amazing to me. And he's not a dummy. He's a very educated person. His wife, very successful businesswoman. She was the CEO of one of the biggest banks in Norway. And she was the one who committed suicide. So these are very accomplished people. And yet, when you say something simple, it's like, wow, this is so profound, right? And it shows you that there is something about the spiritual life that actually works. There's a power to this. And sometimes very simple things are very powerful. So this was the first thing that occurred to me. And the second thing, of course, that occurs to you when these things happen and when you read a sutta like this is that I too have been there, right? I have been that father who lost a son and a wife within 6 months of each other. When I had that, I probably didn't have any wisdom. I didn't have any Buddhist understanding. So I would have suffered just like my friend is suffering now. Right? We've all been there. We have been that son who committed suicide. We have been that wife, his wife, who was very, very intelligent. And I actually liked her a lot. She was a very nice woman, very kind of wholesome, very good-hearted, many, many good qualities. And yet she is not capable of dealing with her son committing suicide. So she too ends up committing suicide. We have been there too, in all of these positions, right? It kind of reminds you that this is how things are. The world is like this. These things happen. Anyway, so that gives you a little bit of a perspective on these issues. Okay, so then we have the next one here. The next one is the simile of the stick. So now we have been talking about how human rebirth, has all these problems. But actually, of course, in Buddhism, we don't just get reborn as humans according to the Buddhist teachings, but you can be reborn in even more difficult situations or in more happy situations, depending on how we live our life. And this is what the simile of the stick is all about. At Samati, because this samsara is without discoverable beginning here. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving here. Just as the stick thrown up into the air falls now on its bottom, now on its side, and now on its top, so too as beings roam and wander on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, now they go from this world to the other world, now they come from the other world to this world. For what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning, etc. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all phenomena, all formations, all phenomena, enough to become dispassionate, to lose all craving or become dispassionate towards all phenomena, enough to be liberated from all phenomena. So this is when you get this greater perspective on life and you start to see what is going, and you look from a distance, And you start to see, it's like your life is like this graph, right? You're kind of jumping up and down from one place to another one, and you're stable for a while, then you go up a little bit, and you go down a little bit, right? This is what kind of life is like. You are going like a stick being thrown up into the air. You don't really know where you are going to go next. All you know, and the reason why you don't know where you're going to go next is usually we don't know whether we are going to make good or bad karma in any particular life. In this life, we have a certain sense of security about things because most people here are doing the right thing, heading in the right direction. But in general, over time, it's not like we are Buddhist always. Sometimes we're not Buddhist, right? Sometimes we are scallywags, right? We're doing doing bad things, right? And then, of course, we're making all the bad karma. And we're not in charge of this. This is, again, the idea of the driverless bus. Because we're not in charge, if you look at this from a distance, and you look at the sequence of lives over a long period of time, it appears like the stick. You just throw a coin in the air, and now it's heads, now it's tails, and you don't really know exactly where you're going to go in that next existence. This is life, right? This kind of this random sequence of events, sequence of rebirth, now in this destination, now in that destination. So again, it's a bit like, it's not very nice. And the problem is that it feels so much that we are in charge, right? It feels in this life like we are in charge of our destiny. It feels like we are in control, and this is part of the problem. Because it feels like we are in control, we tend to think that it's not as much of a problem as it actually is. And this is the delusion of the sense of self, the sense that we think that we are in control, in charge of things. And this is a big part of the problem. But if we understood this idea of the driverless bus fully, if you understood the idea of the ship on the ocean which just drifts according to the prevailing conditions fully, we would see that this is actually much more dangerous than we think it is. There is really nobody in charge. And that is why we have the simile of the stick, right? It's random. It's just, we don't know what's going to happen next. And that is the problem. Okay, so that is a little bit for you about the idea of rebirth. It's quite serious stuff, actually, and it's quite, some people, they feel a little bit sense of despair when they see this kind of things. Some people say that when they see this, they feel that Buddhist teaching is so pessimistic, right? But it's not really about being pessimistic or optimistic. It's not like, you know, you see a picture from the war in Syria and you say, oh, that's so pessimistic. That's the wrong way of looking at it. It's just realistic. That's what's going on, right? And this is the same idea from a Buddhist point of view. It is just being realistic. This is the reality. And this is why the Buddha says we are ignorant. We don't understand. This is the reality from the Buddhist point of view. So, anyway, there's a few things for you to think about. I think we should maybe put this one out again. This is the questions and answers. Check out the old ones. And okay, thanks. And so then that's it for now, and we'll see you again at 7:30 this evening here. Okay, so let us start this evening's questions. So, number one, dear Ajahn, if the yogis keep their mind still by listening to a sound or scanning their body, can they attain Magapala, Sotapanna, etc.? Thank you. Is it possible to attain Magapala? Is like the attainments of the high insights on the path, the awakening insights. Can we get this by listening to the sound or scanning the body? And basically, the idea, you can almost gain these things in any kind of object, if you like. But the idea is that you have to make your mind very still, first of all. So these ideas of just, you know, sitting in the present moment, being aware of what is happening, these are kind of initial practices, just to learn, just to be mindful. For those of you whose meditation is going well, you can just, you know, carry on and do whatever. The point is just that these are the basic things, that this is kind of the hard part of the meditation, just getting to that point where the mind is peaceful, where the mind is mindful, and then the rest of the meditation is much more automatic, if you like. So in a sense, these are the preliminary stages. And once you get into the present moment, once the mind is kind of fairly stable right here, then you can start doing things like watching the breath. And then watching the breath is actually is relatively easy once that mindfulness is established. So, and then through that watching the breath, you can go into very deep states of samadhi. Sometimes you don't actually have to watch the breath. Sometimes these things happen even automatically without that. But the breath is kind of the standard thing, the standard object for getting you there. And then after you come out of a really profound state of samadhi, that is really the time to get the deep insights, right? And then the deep insights can happen. So it is really a long path, but the beginning is certainly by just being present, just being aware, listening to the sounds, scanning the body, all these things. This is just a good start. This is to get you going in the meditation practice. Okay. So, number two. Dear Ajahn, in Majjhima Nikaya number 9, Majjhima Nikaya is one of the collections of suttas, of Buddhist discourses, on right view. Venerable Sariputta teaches the wholesome and unwholesome and the nutriment before the Four Noble Truths or suffering. Is this understanding on nutriment, is this important? Thank you, we've met up. Well, it can be important. You know, the point about the Dhamma is that there are many kind of access ways to understanding this Dhamma. There are many access ways to obtain insight. You know, in the sutta, the Buddha talks about various types of ways of looking at the world. He talks about the 6 sense bases, right? Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and also the mind base. So the 6 sense bases is one way. He talks about the 5 aggregates. For the body contemplation, it talks about the 4 elements. The 4 nutriments is another way of looking at the world. What actually is it that keeps us going in samsara? Is nutriments, I said, the things that kind of drives us forward in this world, the things that keep us going. And so these are one way of looking at the world. I haven't really contemplated these nutriments all that much myself. They are not the most prominent set of factors of, you know, of existence that are mentioned in the suttas. But if you find it useful, you can look at the 4 nutriments. The 4 nutriments are physical food, which is just nutriment for the body. It is volition. Volition, the will, right? The will is like a nutriment for existence and a nutriment for rebirth, because the will is we take as a very essential part of us. We tend to to regard it as us, basically, identify with the will. There is contact. Contact is the ability to experience things. And then there is a consciousness as the 4th nutriment. These are called the 4 aharas, nutriments, in the Pali Suttas. So if you find that useful, you can contemplate those things. But I must admit, it's not something that I have thought all that much about. But there is literature about this thing, so if you're interested in reading about it, you can. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, many of us spend much of our time having to set goals and reporting on our achievements in our spiritual lives, in particular our meditation. You talk of making progress on the pathway and moving in the right direction. Should we consider this as a goal? Should we have goals? Or is this another form of attachment? Thank you for everything here. I'm not sure if it is all that useful to have goals in meditation. One of the things, especially when you have goals, you tend to have craving. You tend to desire achieving those goals. And very often that craving gets in the way, especially of peace. So when you do the meditation practice, if you have too much goals while you're sitting down, you tend to always look into the future. And you're never really satisfied when you have a goal, right? You're never really happy with the present. The idea is to enjoy the here and now. Too much goals leads to dissatisfaction, discontentment, not really being happy with what you have already. So I think, especially in meditation practice, I don't think it is all that useful to have goals. Meditation is really about learning to put in place the causes that lead to something else. So focus on the causes. What is the cause that leads to meditation practice? Well, the cause is to enjoy the present moment, right? To enjoy what you have now. How do you enjoy what you have now? It's just by, you know, thinking in the right way. Wow, isn't this wonderful to be able to sit here, to understand that by being here, you have let go of so many burdens in life, right? So much suffering has been left behind. The more you understand that suffering has been left behind, the more you enjoy just sitting here, because it's actually quite nice compared to the ordinary burdens of life. So, and then just enjoy the peace, right? Enjoy the good company. Enjoy the nice, the nice facilities here. Just get into that positive mood, that positive attitude towards the world. And that positive attitude, these are the kind of things that will make the meditation work. So look at the causes. Look at what actually drives this whole process. And then the goals, what we're actually looking for will come all by itself. And the Buddha says this in the suttas, whether you aspire for this or you don't aspire for this, if you put the goals into, if you put the conditions into place, the goals or the results will happen all by themselves. So I think that is a much better way of doing it. Otherwise, you tend to get frustrated, right? Why am I not getting anywhere? I'm supposed to get somewhere. Well, maybe not supposed to get anywhere. Maybe you're just supposed to kind of sit here, right, and relax. Maybe that's good enough. Why are you supposed to get somewhere? And so just enjoy what you have. And that is often the fastest way to get some kind of result on this path. So don't think you're supposed to get anywhere. Maybe not. Maybe you have to wait. Maybe the results are 5 years down the line. You don't know where your practice is at. You don't know what is happening exactly where you are on this path. This idea of the thinking that we have to get results, that kind of results are due, this could be wrong, may not be right. So forget about all that. Enjoy what you have already. And then also, one of the things that you learn on this path is the importance of all the, how we live our daily lives, right? How you relate to the people around you every day, how you think about everything in the daily life. Everything you do in daily life is integrates into this meditation practice. Next year, when I'm sure I will see some of you again next year, if we are still alive at that stage, of course that is highly uncertain. So now is the opportunity. But the idea is that you see progress over long run usually, right? Over the long run. So a few months pass, a year pass, you come back and you see that things have changed because you have been doing the right thing in the meantime. This is what I do in my monastic life. I look at things over the long term. I never have the idea that I'm going to be a monk for the rest of my life. Maybe I am, I probably am, but I never have that idea, right? I never think like that. I just think now is the time, now I'm practicing, and I can see that there is progress, continuous progress all the time. So then why would I want to do anything else? You know, it's going in the right direction. And if I feel that the progress isn't as good as it should be, then I ask myself, why? Why? What is stopping me from making progress? And there's always a reason for that. There's always something you can do, some perception you have to change. You have to be honest with yourself. You have to be very honest. But once that honesty is there, and you're willing to look at yourself the way you actually are, and make the adjustments and change, then the progress will happen. So look at causes rather than results. Don't strive for goals. Strive for doing what is right in the present moment. What should I be doing right now? Okay, I'm sitting here in meditation. I should just be peaceful. I shouldn't do anything. Just let me sit back and wait and be patient. Or let me just think about something positive and nice from the past that give rise to a little bit of joy in the practice. This is the kind of thing you should be doing here. So that is what I recommend. Maybe for some people having a bit of goals works. I think people are also a bit different, but that is what I would do. And this is very much based on the way Ajahn Ram teaches as well. He doesn't really advise people to have goals. Okay. Dear Arahant, the word Arahant comes just further down. Are there any arahants alive today with metta? That is a good question. Are there any arahants alive today? It is very hard to know, right? You can't really know. And I think there probably are some arahants alive today, but they are very few. They are very rare. You don't find many arahants in the world. And even the number of Aryas, you know, people who are on the way to awakening, who are kind of partially awakened, if you like, even they are very few and far between. Even the people who attain deep samadhi are actually very few and far between. So it is not very common to find these sort of people. But I think they exist, and that is probably the most important thing. These people are still there. The Dhamma is still alive, right? When we have the teachings and we have people who attain these things, then the Dhamma is still alive. It is still in existence. And that is a wonderful thing here. So, but really, don't worry too much about that. Just look at the people in the world that inspire you. If you feel inspired by certain people, allow that is fine to feel inspired by certain people. Don't go overboard by inspiration. Don't put too much faith in any individual, because sometimes you get disappointed, right? They do crazy things. I must admit, I think it's very unlikely that Ajahn Brahm is going to do something absolutely wild and crazy and run off with a woman or anything like that. I can't really imagine that happening here. But sometimes it's easy to get the wrong idea, because especially, if you look at the relationship between the lay Buddhist community and the monastics, it is very hard for the lay people to really see what is going on with the monastics. It's very easy to project onto people, to think that things are there which may not actually be there. It's very, very hard to judge. So just keep an open mind and just watch and see if something is worthy of faith and confidence. Okay, then it is worthy of faith and confidence, without kind of committing your entire life to that. Because otherwise you can get very, very disappointed. So that is really the important thing. So just observe, right? And if something is good, it is likely, if something looks good, it is very likely to be good, especially if you keep observing over a long period of time. And this is what the Buddha said we should be doing, right? We should be observing. We should be watching. Are there any defilements there? Is this person worthy of respect and honor? If over a long period of time you don't really see any defilements, right? What you see instead are all the good states. If you see that over a long period of time, then it is worth placing some confidence in that person. That's one of the beautiful things about the Buddha. He says to us, look at me, right? Look at me. Investigate. Do you see in me any of these bad qualities, or don't you? It's a very powerful thing for a spiritual teacher to say, please investigate me. And what the Buddha obviously is confident is that you won't see any of those bad qualities, because they have been eradicated in somebody who attains full awakening. So that is the answer. It's very hard to know. I can't even give you a definite answer whether there are arahants. How would I know if there are arahants in the world? Except if I was an arahant myself, right? That's the only thing I could know. But if I'm not an arahant myself, I can't really know. I can only guesstimate, just like you, like everybody here. I look out, yeah, probably a few people. But very difficult to know. Okay. So, here we go. Dear Ajahn, right livelihood means one following the Eightfold Path, cannot, should not trade in or engage in weapons, arms, liquor, substance, slaughter animals, etc., etc. This being the case, why are Buddhist monks openly say, do not eat meat or any flesh. We know you avoid meat. In the BSWA, the best example is our Bianca not encouraging laity to bring meat, flesh to the retreats. Thank you, Ajahn. Okay, thank you for a very wonderful teaching. Okay, well, the reason is basically that, in the suttas, the Buddha doesn't say that being a vegetarian is required, right? There is no such rule for the monastics. The Buddha himself would eat meat. That is certainly the way it is described in the suttas. And for that reason, there is no rule about these things. And that is why the monastic community in general, except for the East Asian monastic community in places like China, etc., where they are often vegetarian in the Mahayana tradition, but not in the Theravada tradition, because there are no rules for this. So that is the case. I think it's great to be a vegetarian myself. I think it's wonderful. And if I'm not 100% vegetarian myself, I eat a little bit of fish. But I think it's a great thing, and I would encourage people to do that. If you feel that it's a nice thing to do, and if you feel a sense of coming from compassion, coming from the right thing, then I think it is a very nice thing to do. So please do it for that reason. So I encourage that, but I don't want to kind of make it into a big issue for people to be vegetarian, because it is not made into a big issue by the Buddha. My job as a monastic is to teach Buddhism. It's not to teach kind of modern attitudes to vegetarianism or whatever. I could do that, but I don't feel that is my main purpose as a monastic. So if people ask me, I encourage it, but it's not something that I, you know, tend to make a big point out of. So, yes. And of course, there is lots of arguments why people often say why we should be vegetarian today, even though the Buddha wasn't vegetarian. And I think many of those arguments are valid, you know, that today the meat industry is quite harsh and all these kind of things. And I think these are certainly valid arguments. But please remember, please, if you're going to be a vegetarian, do it in a good way, right? Do it in a way where you come from compassion for the animals. You feel that you're doing something out of kindness. Don't be judgmental of other people, because it is not something that is absolutely necessary on the path to awakening. Often, if you are too judgmental, it just creates conflict and problems, right? People like Ajahn Sujata, he's also a vegetarian. He never mentions that to anybody. He never says anything about it. He just quietly does what he thinks is right. That is what I think is a good way of going about these things. Sometimes we can, you know, if you're vegetarian in the wrong way, it can destroy more than it actually builds up. Okay. Next one. Dear Ajahn, can you please speak more about Kama? I am told that someone can lead a life full of sila, yet he or she can end up being a victim of circumstances, dependent physically on others. It is said that it is ripening of karma from previous lives. Is it true that the conditions can come together at any time? What can we do so that when this happens, our minds are clear and there is wisdom, not full of bitterness and hate? Please advise, is it also true that about collective karma, people dying in a plane crash and natural disasters? Thank you very much, Metta. Okay, so hopefully I was going to talk a little bit more about karma tomorrow morning, because this is part of the idea of right view on the path. So I guess the question here is that when we die, any karma can kind of ripen, right? Is it possible that any karma can ripen and then we kind of go, kind of we meet with some bad circumstances after we die because of that? Is that possible? The thing is that it may be possible, but it is very unlikely. What really determines your future destination is your general way of living in this life. And if your general way of living is good, you are very likely to go to a good destination after you pass away. So it is your general life that actually matters. Everybody makes mistakes. It's impossible to live a life completely without mistakes. But if your general conduct is good, if you're generally a good person with a good heart, you can expect to go to a good destination after you pass away. But be careful, right? It has to be genuine. You really have to do the practice properly, right? That is what really matters here. If some kind of thing happens at the time you die, which kind of gives rise to something negative, and perhaps it leads to a bad destiny, whatever, then that it is very likely you will only go to that bad destiny for a very short period of time, because the power of the general goodness will then tend to carry you along much more powerfully than that short-term thing which happens. Often there is a gap between lives, right? And part of that gap between lives, it allows you, the karma, to kind of even out. So even if you die in a negative way, you know, maybe you have a bit of anger or whatever, because you have that little bit of time in between lives, it gives you a chance for the mind to find a balance again, and then the general karma to ripen as a consequence. So I don't think there is all that much of a risk there. If you live a good life, basically you will have good results as a consequence. Okay. So what can we do so that our minds are clear and with wisdom, right? Not full of bitterness and hate. Well, you just have to practice, right? Just do the right thing here. Make sure that sometimes we don't know when we're going to die. We can't really control our death very often. So sometimes it's impossible to ensure 100% that your mind is going to be clear when you die. Sometimes that's impossible. But all you can do is just make the best out of it, right? So do your best now, practice now. And if you do your best now, the chances are that things will also be good when eventually you pass away. And of course, when you pass away, then make sure you have the right people around you, right? Make sure that you invite somebody who kind of lifts you up and gives you a sense of happiness when you pass away. Not somebody who kind of drags you down too much. A bit of support is always nice towards the very end of life. Collective karma, this is a kind of a not really a Buddhist idea at all. This comes in different religions and different spiritual traditions and teachings. Yes, a lot of people might die in a plane crash or natural disaster, but it's not really about karma. It's just that, you know, if you are a human being, this is what you can expect sometimes. Sometimes you can die in a natural disaster. Sometimes you die in a plane crash. Not because everybody has the same karma, but because everybody is human. And this is what the human state does to you sometimes. You die in these ways. So, not really. We all have individual karma. It's the individual karma that leads to whatever results for the future. So just keep on doing the right thing. That is the best way. And that is the most, what really matters the most for the future. Okay, we'll talk more about karma tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, thank you for a wonderful retreat. My son suffers from depression. Can you suggest ways that I can help him? Thank you so much. Okay, how do you help a son who suffers from depression? Well, sometimes, you know, if it is a severe case of depression, maybe a bit of medication is okay. It's never bad to use some kind of medication. But I think the most important thing that any parent can do for a child is just to love them, right? To be kind to them, to show that you care. This is the most important thing here. And if we do that, then in a sense we are giving them the possibility of being themselves, being natural, feeling that they are cared for in the world. They don't have to prove anything to us. We give them an unconditional form of love. That is the most important thing a parent can do to a child. And a child who gets that kind of upbringing, they become very free in the world because they feel a sense of security inside of themselves. They don't feel kind of, you know, the world is out to get me. They feel they have a place of safety, a place of refuge because of that. So I think this is really the most important thing. And if we do that, then these kind of issues, you know, depression or any other difficulties in life, very often they will eventually work themselves out. So often these things are not things that can be solved very quickly, right? They may have very deep-seated causes and rooted in very deep things. And there's only so much that can be done sometimes. Sometimes it is not that easy. But as a parent, just show your care, I think, is the most important thing here. And it's not about praising them too much and all this kind of things. It's more heartfelt care that I think is really matters. So, of course, sometimes it can be useful to get some medication. Sometimes it can be useful to get some professional help. Sometimes meditation can be very useful, but it really depends on, you know, whether your son is interested in those kind of things, right? You can only do so much. A bit of spiritual input can often be very powerful if you're interested in that. one of the things that a spiritual life does, it gives you a sense of meaning, right? And sometimes people have no meaning in life. If you have no meaning in life, it's very easy to get depressed. You're not feeling happy. So in a sense, that all of these things are possible if your son is interested. But he really has to be interested in the first place. Okay. Dear Adam, can you tell us about yourself? Okay. How did you become a monk and ended up here? Did spend time in other countries as well? Thank you for an inspiring retreat. Okay. Tell me about myself. Okay. It's pretty boring talking about myself. You know, just another person on this planet wandering around trying to make the best of my life. You're not just like everyone else, really. But it is a little bit interesting how I became a monk, because it's one of those weird things, right? You live somewhere far away from the Buddhist world. You have no Buddhist friends. You don't know anything about Asia very much or anything like that. And somehow you have this attraction towards something that you don't know anything about. It's kind of weird. And I had this attraction already from fairly young. I wanted to travel to Asia. I wanted to try meditation practice. All of these things were kind of natural. It just happened, in a sense. And the only way I can explain that, and the only way I can explain coming across the Buddhist teachings and actually feeling some sense of familiarity with this, is that I must have been a Buddhist in a past life, right? I don't know where. I was probably living in Asia somewhere. I was probably a Buddhist in Asia somewhere in a past life. And then that is what is kind of carrying on in this life. It's the only way I can really explain my own interest in these things and why, for me, it was quite natural to become a monk. I remember when I was, even as a child, I was sometimes thinking about living for myself, right? Somewhere far away, as if I was a monk already. I don't know where that comes from. It must come from something deep in the past. So this is how I think I ended up here. And then I found out, at the time I was living in England, in the UK, and I found out about the monasteries over there. So I went to the monasteries over in England, and that's where I started out, Chithurst and Amravati monasteries. You may have heard of Ajahn Sumedho, etc. And then one day I heard a talk by Ajahn Brahma, right? And somebody else said, listen, there's a talk by this other teacher. Check this out, right? And I read this talk by Ajahn Brahma, and strange, I knew straight away this is my teacher. So I said to the monks, so I want to go to Australia. And they said, oh, no, don't go to Australia. You're just being restless. You just want to travel around. You know, what you need to do is settle down and stay in the same place. And often that is probably true, right? Probably that often is the case. People are just restless. But I somehow knew this was the right thing. And of course, since I came here, this is where I have been staying ever since. There are very few people who stay as long in one monastery as I have done. I've been here for over 20 years now. So that's really it. That's really all I have to say. It's pretty boring, not all that exciting. Anyway, so. Okay, next one. Dear Ajahn, you watch the breath during meditation. A beginner finds it difficult to distinguish between watching the breath and getting involved with the breath precisely, or putting an effort to make breathing. Yeah, that's a very good point. Please could you guide to do one instead of two? Thank you. Yeah, that's a very good point. This is this feeling when you watch the breath. Often you get involved with the breath, right? It's like you have lost that distance, and you're not really just watching as if you're watching the sunset or watching a movie, but it's almost as if you are controlling the breath. And when you are involved and you are controlling and you are it's really about holding on, then the breath becomes uncomfortable. It's no longer easy. It's no longer relaxed. And this is why so much of part of the meditation is to get the foundations right. Once the foundation is right, once you have that sense of distance and all you're doing is sitting back, observing the breath without any kind of involvement, once you get to that point, things are actually quite easy. This is why you have to allow the natural mindfulness to arise first of all, right? This is all of these preparation things are about that, to allow the mindfulness to arise. And mindfulness is just the ability to sit back and observe, to be present in the here and now. That is what mindfulness is about. The mind is not moving, not thinking too much, not going into the past, not going into the future. And you're just aware. And when you do that, when you are aware like that, then at some point, it's as if the breath just comes to you. The breath is always around, right? So the breath is there, and then is the right time to watch the breath. The breath is suddenly just there. It's like it appears as part of the of what you are aware of. You're not searching for it. You know, because you're not searching for it, you're not holding on, you're not grasping it, you're not getting involved with the breath. It is just like you're watching a movie. The breath is out there somewhere, you're watching it. If you find yourself getting involved, right, it gets too close. This happens because we are afraid of losing the breath. As soon as there is a sense that you're losing the breath, you tend to grasp a little bit. That's where the involvement begins. If you find that's happening, let go. Don't watch the breath anymore. Go back to the beginning. Just relax again and try to kind of start from scratch. Because once you start holding on, it means that you are no longer relaxed. Your mind is going to get tired very quickly. It's going to be unpleasant. You're going to get fed up with meditation. And you're not going to enjoy what you're doing. It is so fundamental that you enjoy what you're doing here. Right? Enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. It has to be something nice. Not 100% of the time, that's impossible, but generally speaking, it should be nice. So that is really the way to go about it. Just get the foundations right. I think the vast majority of people, they go to the breath too quickly. You jump onto the breath, but just wait with the breath. Don't worry about the breath. Allow the breath to come to you. You don't go to the breath. And when the breath comes to you, it is natural. It is easy. There's no effort involved. And the whole thing flows along very nicely. And then when the meditation flows along, then that is when it is beneficial, it feels good, it's delightful, and all the good things come from that. So try that. If that doesn't work, come back with another question tomorrow. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how is the idea of God, the Creator, the beginning, comes about? Okay. Any explanation by the Buddha? I talked about this today, right? So maybe this, I'm not sure. I was talking today about how in Buddhism there is no beginning. The Buddhist teachings, we don't talk about the beginning. What we talk about is causality. One thing creating something else. Things just going back and back in the past. So there is no, from the Buddhist point of view, there is no first point. You know, if you find a certain point, you can always go before that. And always go before that. And things are always moving. There's always another cause before what you see already. And this, to me, is a very realistic idea of the world, that there is no first point. So from Buddhist point of view, there is no point of creation. Because there is no point of creation, there is no need for a creator God, right? This is why, there is no creator God in Buddhism. There's nobody needed to create this everything. It is just a self, it's just a mechanism that runs by itself. This is what samsara is all about. It just runs and runs by itself. And if there is a creation in Buddhism, it is the creation that we do mentally. It is the mind that really creates the universe. In a very nice little sutta, the Buddha says that the beginning, the origin, and the end of this universe, of the world, is found in this, what he calls this fathom-long body, right? Within us, we are the ones who either start or end the universe. And this is what kind of, in a sense, the practice of the Buddhist path is all about. It's about ending the universe. In the end, there is only one type of universe, and that is the personal one that we have inside of us. Right? We are aware of things. We are aware of things going on. And that is, in a sense, really the only true, at least from a personal point of view, the only real universe. Whatever there is out there is kind of unknown and uncertain. We can never really know that. All we can really know is our own personal experience. And that can come to an end. But that personal experience doesn't actually have a starting point. It just goes back and back and back. So there is no need for the idea of a God, right? No creator. And that's quite handy. So, you know, sometimes people despair, you know, they have been Christians or whatever, and then they don't lose their belief in God for whatever reason. And then that is very difficult. But in Buddhism, that whole thing is kind of superfluous. Don't need that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I didn't quite get your guided meditation last night. Can you please outline the steps again? Thank you. So I just did that tonight, hopefully. Hopefully you have slowly getting there. You know, the steps of meditation, very simply, the idea is to start off always with the body. Feel your body. Make sure you're comfortable, first of all. Sit on a chair if you have to, right? Then feel the general comfort. Make sure that the body is incredibly relaxed. The more relaxed the body is, the more relaxed and at ease is also the mind. The two go together. They're two sides of the same coin. If the body isn't really 100% relaxed, it usually is because the mind is controlling the body to some extent. So the more relaxed you can be in the body, the more you're also relaxing the mind. Right? So it's in a sense, it's an indirect way of making sure everything, your whole being is relaxed. It's an indirect way of going about that, focusing on the body. So stay with the body, right? It's also a good way of learning mindfulness, just staying with the body. You're aware of what's happening inside of you. And then it's also a good way of learning the right attitude, because the way that the body relaxes is by you having the right attitude towards it. So you have a good feeling towards your body. You say to yourself, may you be well. If you have a pain, you kind of soothe yourself. You say, okay, you know, relax, be happy, enjoy yourself. You deserve a break, body. Right? Thank you for all your services over all these years. You've been a good body doing your best in spite of all the problems in life, etc., etc. So you build up like that good, positive perception. And all of these things together means that you're heading in the right way just by focusing on the physical body. You get the attitude, you get the peace and calm, etc., etc. And if you carry on like that, then mindfulness arises as a consequence. And you feel naturally at ease in the present moment. And that natural and ease in the present moment is what we mean by mindfulness. Not too much thinking about the past, no thinking about the future, no fantasizing about all kinds of stuff, right? You're just generally aware, because it's pleasant to be here. And if it isn't pleasant enough, then we use some of the reflections the Buddha taught us to use. Reflect on the past good conduct, reflect on your generosity, reflect a bit about the Buddha, right, about the Dhamma, all of these things that can give rise to joy. Whatever is joyful in your life, reflect on that. But it has to be spiritual joy, not kind of worldly joys. But if it is that spiritual joy, it is something which leads you in the right direction. So it's supposed to be a very simple path, right? Really, all you have to do is just sit back and wait, really. I remember Ajahn Brahm in the early years, he only gave one meditation instruction in the early years. People asked him, oh, I'm not getting anywhere in my meditation. What should I do? And Ajahn Brahm said, sit longer. That's what he said. That was the only meditation instruction he would ever give. Sit longer. But I already sat for an hour, sit for another hour. And this was his instruction. Because if you are ready, that works, right? If you are ready, if you have built up all the good qualities inside of you, that is what works. So if you are patient and you just sit, things will tend to happen if you are ready for it. Okay. Anapanasati, is this the preparatory work to do before the actual meditation of letting go? Anapanasati is actually not preparatory at all. Anapanasati is a very profound meditation technique. And I think that this is, I know that in the Goenka meditation technique, they start off with anapanasati straight away. I must admit, I find maybe if you are ready for that, it may work for a small minority of people. But to me, anapanasati is actually a very advanced type of meditation. And it's only a meditation that works if you start off with mindfulness. And we're going to have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the Buddha's words on how to do the breath meditation later on. And one of the things that stand out in that sutta is establish mindfulness first of all. In other words, there is no, can be no anapanasati unless mindfulness is already present. Right? And this is so important to teach these things, because if you don't teach these things, anapanasati is going to be, like you mentioned before, a matter of holding on, of grasping, of being involved, rather than being something which is very easy and relaxed, where you have some kind of a perspective and distance to your meditation object. So do all these other things first, and then when the breath comes to you, that is the right time to do anapanasati. Then it becomes very powerful. It becomes incredibly powerful meditation. And it becomes so powerful, in fact, that that meditation will take you all the way to awakening. You don't have to do anything else except watch your breath. Very, very nice, right? Very simple. All you have to do is watch your breath. And then that goes all the way to awakening here. It's very, very nice sometimes to get some very simple instructions, and we can just follow those, and that takes us all the way here. But you have to do it at the right time. One of the most important things on the Buddhist path is how to know what, when is the right time to do what. This is one of the most important things. If we do things in the right sequence at the right time, then we will have success. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. Okay, next one. Ooh, this is a big question. Okay, dear Ajahn, the Earth is 4 billion years old. Life on Earth, rather than in the ocean, goes back roughly 520 million years. As of the fine flora in the sediments, human life evidence is 65,000 years, more or less, maximum, as of the findings. According to the Buddha, the tears one human shed is over the volume of 4 oceans. Once reborn, the 60,000 years human history is not enough to fill four oceans equivalent of tears. Yes, that's a fair, being very mathematical here, very precise. That's good. Okay, now question number one. Does it mean humans were living on other planets? That is a possibility, right? Maybe we were all together in some other planet. Maybe we were all green, right, with little antennas on our heads, and we were living far away. Maybe, it's possible. Certainly, the Buddha suttas, this is quite interesting, the Buddha suttas are all about different world systems, right? Different people, human beings living in different world systems. And very fascinating, because now we know that in recent years, astronomy has been searching for extraterrestrial planets. And they're kind of starting to find planets out there which are roughly right for carrying life, right? So gradually, we're kind of coming to that conclusion on scientific means, that very likely there is life out there somewhere in the universe. The Buddha said this 2,500 years ago, that there's life out there, right? This is one of the kind of amazing, it really is quite amazing, is that the Buddha's teaching, the sort of things that the Buddha said 2,500 years ago about the universe, about the world, are actually quite astonishing. He says things like the Earth will burn up because the sun's become so hot. The only difference, he talks about 7 suns rather than 1 sun, but he says that it will get so hot that the Earth burns up, right? Of course, now we know that that's exactly the case. He talks about universe after universe, about, you know, basically about evolution and then dissolution, as if you have big bangs and then big contractions. Now, science these days talks about the Big Bang. Whether there is a big contraction is one of those big debates going on, and nobody is sure, but this is what the Buddha says. So let's find out. Maybe a few years down the line, maybe we will see science also falling in line. Maybe not, but it is a possibility, right? It's interesting. And the Buddha talks about all these things, and also about other beings, other planets, and all of that is already part of it. And it is quite, to be honest with you, it is quite astonishing how these Buddhist teachings are so broad, right? They are about such a, you know, they are not kind of teachings about a certain people at a certain time in history, which very often is what religious teachings are about. They are about these big universal questions, cosmic questions. And they're talking about things in this enormous time span, and enormous things. It is just a completely different viewpoint from what we normally talk about as religion in the world. It's not really religion in the same way. It's almost like an explanation of the world that's really what it is. And it's quite astonishing here. So it is possible that we were living on other planets. It's possible that the human realm was a bit different from what it is now. It is possible that we were all animals, right? Animals cry too, right? They may not have sometimes they have perhaps physical tears. At other times, they certainly cry in the heart, even if nothing physical is coming out. And those of you who have pets will know that. Pets will also be tremendously traumatized if some other animal or some human close to them are, disappear or whatever. So maybe physical tears might just be is just part of this, of course. So there's lots of possibilities here. Did the Buddha believe there were billions of lifetimes in non-flesh forms prior to being born as humans on Earth to have shed such large volumes of tears? Thank you. Well, remember the Buddha talks about all these different world systems. He talks about eons of, the world, the world developing and then kind of contracting again or dissolving again, So there probably have been other Earths before or similar kind of planets. There's been heaps of opportunities to be born as human beings. And as you say, quite possibly we have been born as different kind of beings. And there too we have cried, right? So all of these things added together is really what he's talking about. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what exactly did you say to your friend who lost his wife and son? I missed the point. Could you repeat? So much, thank you. It's not very interesting. I said something very, very obvious. I said, this too will pass. Yes, exactly. This too will pass, right? Very straightforward, basic Buddhist teachings, the teaching of anicca. And it's one of those teachings which actually are very powerful. If you take to heart, this too will pass. You will never take your sufferings or your happinesses, for that matter, in life. You won't take them so seriously anymore. You won't commit suicide because you have so much suffering, because you know it will eventually pass. Right? So it helps you to go through the difficult times. It is taken from a story in one of Ajahn Brahm's books, where he talks about a prisoner who gets locked up and he gets into this prison cell and he feels really depressed, right? It's all concrete and it's all kind of steel bars, Oh no, I have to suffer with this for just because I made a mistake. Why? This is really unfair. And he looks around him and he feels really depressed. And then one day he sees in the corner of the cell somebody has engraved something into the concrete, right? So he goes over and looks and he sees engraved there, this too will pass. And that is what carries him through that prison sentence, and it carries him through life afterwards as well, always remembering this too will pass. Right? This is a simple thing, but very, very powerful if you use it in the right way, if you understand what's going on. That was the first thing I said to him. The second thing that, when people commit suicide, there's often a stigma in our society about suicide. It often is a stigma in Buddhist circles as well. People say, suicide is very bad, right? And sometimes people say that somebody has just committed suicide and some Buddhist will tell them, suicide is very bad. Please don't say that. If somebody has committed suicide in somebody's family, don't tell them it is very bad, because obviously it's not going to be a very... It is going to just make the situation even more difficult. In fact, we cannot know if it is bad or good. Bad or goodness in Buddhism is about intention, right? Why are we committing suicide? If we are committing suicide to kind of take revenge on somebody, of course, then it's bad karma and it's not a good thing. But if we commit suicide because it is at the end of our life and just the physical pain of being in existence and the illness is so bad and there is no hope for any more life quality, and we say, okay, I've had enough of this, and you are just basically realizing that there's no point in going on, Well, that is not coming from a bad state of mind. It's not coming from the desire to hurt anyone. It's not coming from some kind of distorted desire or anything. It's just a sense of compassion towards yourself. There is no point with this. It's a bit like if you have an illness, you go to hospital, you go to a doctor to get it sorted out, right? It's crazy to say, oh no, this is my karma, I have to bear this illness. You always go to the doctor. And sometimes, if our dying process, we come to the end, is incredibly difficult, we are in enormous amounts of pain, then sometimes that may be the right way out. And sometimes it is the same thing with somebody committing suicide, right? It is just too hard to bear. He lost his wife, and I think, I haven't asked him about this, but I think it's fairly obvious that his wife committed suicide because she wasn't able to deal with the loss of her son, right? So because of that, it was just too painful. And then she commits suicide. And then possibly, you can't really blame her for that. She's just doing something to end the painful situation. It's not coming from a very bad motive, perhaps a little bit of delusion, but that's really all. And then I said to her, maybe now she is in a much better place than she was beforehand, because she was not able to deal with that incredibly difficult situation of losing her son, right? It is very hard to know what is going on, and it is possible that now things are better. Because we can't know, we might as well take a positive approach to these things, because you can't really know what's going on. So I just told this to my friend. This is a possibility. This is one way that things may have worked out. And of course, if he thinks about his wife and he thinks that she is more happy where she is now, maybe his son is also more happy. And if there is no really stigma, with committing suicide anyway, then of course the whole situation becomes much easier to bear with. And that's when he said to me, oh, wow, that's really profound wisdom, right? But actually, it is not, from my point of view, it's not all that profound, but it's just kind of common sense, really. Okay, so we have come to the last one for this evening. Dear Ajahn, if somebody has gone through violence, always trying to control by parents, and if that person decides to live away from the parents, does that person have a wrong view? Okay, so if you had violent parents, and then you decide, parents who try to control you, etc., and then you decide to live away from your parents because of that, is that wrong view? No, not really. It's not really wrong view. What we have to remember is that in this world we have obligation towards our parents, but we also have obligation towards ourselves, right? If we are so unfortunate that we grow up with violent parents, sometimes you have to look after yourself, you have to care for yourself, you have to know that you can't take this anymore, so you have to move away. It doesn't mean that you are bad to your parents, it just means that you have a sense of compassion for yourself. And by taking yourself out of that situation, out of that difficult situation, you get more perspective. And once you have more perspective, that is when the healing process can start. And when the healing process can start, psychologically, etc., then you are actually able to deal with your parents in a wiser and more skillful and compassionate way as a consequence of that. So sometimes you have to take yourself away, first of all. Take yourself away. Then you get perspective, then you start to understand, then you are more able to actually do the right thing towards your parents. It's a bit like me, right? I became a monk, and my parents would rather I didn't become a monk, but should I not become a monk because my parents thought otherwise? Would that have been the right choice? I don't think so, because my parents didn't really understand what it means to be a monk, right? They didn't know what it means. And I think now, after I've been doing this for 20 years, I think they're actually quite grateful that I made this choice. Because now we can actually talk about useful things rather than talk about all the nonsense that you often talk about in families, right? We can actually talk about something constructive. Talk about meditation. They say, let's do some meditation together. Talk about virtue. Talk about, wisdom and all these things. That's much more useful, right? So actually, you can have a reasonable conversation with your family instead of all the kind of the ordinary stuff that people talk about. What a wonderful thing that is. And I always tell my parents, wow, you get quality. You know, you may not get quantity, you get quality whenever you see me. Be happy. And I think they realize that's actually the case. That actually is true. They are getting more quality than they would have otherwise. So this is all about, you know, so sometimes it is right to withdraw, and we have to know that sometimes that is the right thing to do. Okay, so that is all for this evening. We'll see you again tomorrow morning here.